Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. What happens to all that leftover food that doesn't get sold at a grocery store or a restaurant? Much of it's probably wasted, right? An app called Too Good To Go is giving consumers the option to buy this food for a discounted price. Sarah Soderoff from Too Good To Go takes us through how it works. Then, with fraudsters getting more sophisticated, it is more important than ever to stay vigilant. Now you can test your scam sense with an online quiz. Vivian Gauci, Senior Vice President at Home Equity Bank, talks about the quiz and how it helps to bring awareness on ways you can reduce your fraud risk. And the first Indigenous-owned investment dealer in Canada. It's called Cedarleaf Capital. Its CEO, Clint Davis, will be here to tell us how this supports Indigenous communities and a path towards reconciliation. Plus, I'll speak with the co-founder and CEO of Wilbur. It is a budgeting app that pays you to do surveys online. What? Mike Rodenberg will be here. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Have you ever wondered what happens to all of that unsold food, either in the, you know, the grocery store deli counter or the restaurants? Like, it's still good, but it's not, you know, no one's consuming it in the day. Well, of course, so much of that goes to waste. Except if you are someone who has downloaded a particular app on your phone called Too Good To Go. They're trying to address this problem, to allow businesses to sell some surplus food and to give consumers an opportunity to buy some of that food at a discounted price. To talk about how it works, we're joined by Sarah Soderoff. She is the senior PR manager at Too Good To Go. She joins us today from New York City, even though mostly she's in Canada. Hello there.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
My sister saw a poster for your app in her local supermarket, and I thought, what an interesting personal finance story. Of course, it's a story about the environment and a story about efficiency and all those things. But on this program, it's about money. How much could a consumer save by buying something through the Too Good To Go app? What kind of a discount are we talking about?
Yeah, well, we love your sister for that. Thank you so much for sharing it, for having her share it. We do work with grocers all across Ontario, all across Canada, Metro, Longo's. We have specialty grocery stores. So really anyone can sell their food with us, and the consumer gets about a 1/3 discount off the original price. So if you're seeing in the app, grocery stores have actually great options because they might have a baked good category, then they might have prepared foods, they might have produce. Each of those, you're probably getting around $24 worth of food for about $6. So you'll see the original value in the app, and then you'll see a bolded amount, and that's what you pay. Everything is transacted through the app, so no money changes hands when you go to pick up your bag, but you're really getting a ton of value for that lower cost price. And it's just as you said, it's so that the store can recoup some of that lost revenue, but ultimately so that they're not also throwing out that food, which has harmful effects on the environment. And we're seeing grocery prices hugely increase for consumers. So this also helps them save money at home.
So I've downloaded the app. I've got it on my phone. I put in the region in which I'm interested, and then I get some offers that come up on my phone. Tell us what else a consumer would see and how it would work for them such that they can take advantage of this.
Yeah, super easy. All you do is go to the Google Play or Apple App Store. You download the app. It's called Too Good To Go. So if you start typing that in, it should show up. The only thing it'll ask you for is your location, because we are a location-based service. So you'll see, I like to put around like 30 kilometers in my radius, and then I can see everything that's available in my local area. I filter by just what's available. So there's a little button at the top. You can slide that over. So it says that you hide sold out. So you're only seeing what's available today. And then you're going to see a bunch of green dots. Those green dots represent the food that is available for you to purchase. When you click on a dot, it will bring up the store, it'll bring up the category, and you'll see the original amount, you'll see the amount you pay, and then a little description about that food. And typically what it'll say you're picking up a baked goods bag, it'll say this might be croissants or cookies or anything, bagels, anything that didn't sell throughout the course of business. But it can be even something like, after Valentine's Day, we had a bunch of partners who put on specialty bags of chocolates because by February 15th, they no longer could sell those at full price. So they had a ton of surplus. So you might see specialty items. Metro, like I was saying, is one of our great partners across the province. They have a cake bag every once in a while, which is really fun. So at their bakery, they are always doing cakes that maybe don't get sold. And so you can get a whole cake for, I think, $6.99. So it's awesome. And then you
reserve happy it. Birthday, Desiree. And then you just take a little knife and scrape you know what? That part off.
That's a really good point, though, because people are always asking, well, why is the food surplus? It might be for a reason like that. Maybe they spelled Desiree incorrectly, so yeah. They can't use it, but the food is still perfectly great to eat. And so it could be that. It could just be that it didn't get sold, but there are a lot of versions of imperfect food that you might get on the app, too.
So you click, oh, yeah, I want that. And then under cover of night, you go into a secret door in the back of the store and you utter a code word or something like that. I'm teasing. How do you pick up the food? Because this isn't something that a supermarket's going to want to make a really big deal about, especially if they're, you know, higher end. They take great pride in the quality of the products that they sell.
You know, they do, though. So it's all the walk in through the front door. You don't have to do anything. Secret. You do get a code, though. And so that's really helpful because the code that appears on your phone will be the same code the store gets. So they can verify that you are who you say you are. But stores love it because they hate waste. The first thing we ask any store when we enter into is, how much are you wasting? And they will reflect it back in a dollar amount. So we'll say, how much food are you wasting per week? And they'll tell us $500, $1,000 worth of food. They know because they put that investment in. They've also, in a lot of cases, put time investment, resource investment, not to mention just the, you know, kind of like actual products of the food. We work with a bunch of high-end restaurants and partners like Summerhill and Eataly, and they love it because it allows them to get rid of that food. They're lowering their emissions. And then also people typically buy something more when they're in store. And that's kind of the hidden value for a lot of partners. On average in the grocery sector, they spend an extra $18 in store. So for the store, and we're not taking any of that, that goes directly to the store. So for the store, you're getting new people in store, more foot traffic, and you're getting more purchases.
What have you learned about your ideal app user? Because I think I'd be someone who this would work for, because to me, the best before dates are a recommendation. Whereas for other people, they're like, no, I'm not having anything. They would never buy day old anything. What have you learned about the person for whom this is a fit?
Honestly, it's a question I get asked the most, and it's a bad answer because it's really right for everyone. You just have to find the angle that works for you. So I typically do my grocery shopping on Sundays. I'll go to the produce stand at the end of my street. I'll pick up a Too Good To Go bag. Whatever I get in that bag that I didn't get that was on my list, then I'll go and buy full price. But I've already gotten a discount there. I'll tell you anecdotally, I was at a coffee shop this morning and I had my computer open. And so I had a little sticker, Too Good To Go sticker on it. And a mother came up to me with her two kids and she said, I love Too Good To Go. And I was like, you are a plant. I wish I could have planted you.
Right.
She said, how do you use it? And she said, bread has gotten so expensive. I make sandwiches every day for my kids. I make toast for them. So I'll buy a whole bunch of bread on the app, freeze it, and then I'll have it on hand. And when I defrost it, it's still perfectly fresh. My kids can't tell the difference and I am saving money. So there's tons of ways for everyone to access what makes the most sense for them.
One of the interesting things as I was logging onto the app is that it gives you the opportunity to set the days in which you want to be notified of deals, which is relevant to me because I know that on Tuesday nights, pickleball, I may have time to go to, you know, my local supermarket, but on Wednesdays, I'm on the air all the afternoon. I'm never going to have a chance so that I'm not going to get alerted to deals that I can't take advantage of. Tell us a bit more about how that works and how that fits with people's lives.
Yeah, thank you for that. I play dodgeball on Tuesday nights, so I'm in a similar situation. And it really does work with your schedule. So, you know, even when you're traveling, you can make it work on, you put your location in when you're traveling and you can pick up bags from anywhere that we operate in, any city we operate in. But the goal is really to reflect the unpredictability of food waste. So a store isn't going to know, oh, I have this exact amount every day, because if they did, then they just wouldn't make it and they wouldn't purchase it. So what we're allowing them to do is have that flexibility. They can upload food when they have it. They can put on different values when they have it. They can change the categories when they have it. And then as a user, you're also maybe not doing your shopping every day, or maybe you're not in the office every day. Maybe you're at home, so you're not going on the same pattern. So you don't need to see that same notification every day. You can pick it so it works with your schedule as well. I'm usually in the office Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So when I go into the office, I can pick up different bags than when I'm at home, but I don't want those notifications on a Tuesday because I can't get it. So I'm going to have to go 20 kilometers out of my way for no reason. So it really is user-friendly and store-friendly, but what works for you.
We live in a world in which underutilized capacity is being utilized in ways that we never thought of before. So all the things, Airbnb, Uber, Too Good To Go, all these things, and they all have different business models. How do you make your money?
We are a for-profit business, so thank you for asking. We take a flat fee off of every transaction. It's $2. So what you see on the app, you'll see $6.99, for example. We take $2 regardless of the size of that bag or the cost of that bag. So if you have a bag for $9.99, we take two. If you have a bag for $6.99, we take two. The store takes everything else. So the user is only paying directly what they see in the app. There's not a siphoning off of that or an additional fee. It's pretty simple user situation, pretty simple monetary model. And our goal is to be profitable. We believe that businesses can both do good while also making money. And so we are growing and expanding quickly on that goal. And the more stores we have, the more we can help to save the planet. And the more users we have, the more that we can help to reduce that food waste.
I mentioned my researcher slash sister tipped me off to this, but this is an app that you can use in lots of different parts of the world. Where did it first start?
We are a Danish company. So we were founded in Copenhagen, Denmark.
Was that a pun? Was that a pun because people can get Danishes on Too Good To Go? Is that what just happened there?
No. And honestly, that I didn't even occur to me, but thank you for calling
it. You can use that. We're a Danish company, but now we sell roast chicken as well.
There's a ton of Danishes on the app, I promise you. But yeah, so we expanded throughout Europe in the past 5 and 6 years. We came to Canada in 2021, and we are now also covering about 50% of the US. So in Canada, we are national, which is fantastic. We're in every city with a population over 100,000, but we are continuously expanding and then increasing that market penetration in the markets in which we operate.
How much work is it for a restaurant or a supermarket to get themselves, it's easy to download the app, but change their process and their way of thinking to say, wait a sec, let's not turf that. Let's put it on Too Good To Go. How much of a cultural shift has that been for the sellers of the food?
I think it's a really interesting trajectory that we've seen grow. When we first started, I started before the app was launched in Canada, so I've been with it since day one. And when we first walked into stores, we would hear a lot of people who had kind of their guards up. There was a big barrier to entry because it didn't make sense. Yeah. Then once you explain it, stores think, okay, what's the catch? And so the quickest way we get to that answer is just by saying there's no catch. And also, this is something that works really around the schedule that you have and the surplus that you have. So the stores usually typically end up saying, like, well, why didn't this exist before? And it's a great question. We're happy to be the first to bring it to Canada. But the goal is really to work in a system that helps them. The goal is not to create a new process. That's why we have the surprise bag functionality as well. We don't want them itemizing or taking photos or having to upload new content or hire somebody new or have a new system in place. They can work it on their phone. So it's really super, super easy system for them to implement. And the goal is to allow them to make actual money off of their surplus. I think we all want to do great work and we all want to help the environment, but if there isn't that push to also have some way for you to profit off of it, it's going to be a really difficult thing to implement. And now I'd say the biggest thing is really just being able to scale as fast as we get the requests for us to go into new markets. So as we see in markets like where your sister was in Markham, potentially we need more around that area. So we call on any food selling business to join us. You can go to toogoodtogo.com, really easy to sign up. And then you can just check it out. And if it doesn't work, there is no contract holding.
Stop doing that. You mentioned surprise bags. Just before we go here, what could be in a surprise bag?
So genuinely anything. I got a surprise bag. You'll see the category. So you're never going to get something like an avocado and a bagel. Right. But you'll pick the category that you get. Baked goods is our most populous category, as you can imagine, but that could encompass anything from baguettes to Danishes to muffins, anything that falls underneath what the store would sell. But we also have a ton of bags like produce bags, which are my favorite because you're getting lettuce and potatoes and fruits and vegetables all at a super discount. And I can do so much with that. Also, we have prepared food items. So if you think of any store that works with a delivery service, potentially they have canceled orders. Those can go on the app, or they have raw items that they didn't sell, maybe like a pizza dough that didn't get turned into a pizza. So they might just sell the pizza dough as is. So it's genuinely anything. We work with convenience stores. We're launching with 7-Eleven across the country as well. And so it can be, you know, chips and chocolate bars and pop.
Pogo sticks.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, honestly,
how do you ensure food safety? I would bet there are a lot of consumers out there like, you say that roast chicken came from today, but now how do I know?
Now, we do rely on our partners to have the highest level quality of control. It is not in their best interest to be selling anything that is past the point where it can be consumed or that it would make you sick. It really is in the best interest of everyone to have that quality control. We also rely on our consumers. We have a very vocal and two-way street of they can share with us anything that they got that didn't meet their standards. The food that goes into a Too Good To Go bag has to meet the same rigorous standards that it would have to meet if it were being sold for full price. So the same way that when you go and pick up a slice of pizza or a rotisserie chicken, you're not inspecting it, but you know that there has been systemic checks that have gone into that. The exact same thing happens with Too Good To Go bags. But if you do get anything that you're not happy with the quality, you can let us know and get a refund.
Fascinating. Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Sarah Sodaroff is with Too Good To Go. If you haven't checked out the app, play around with it. It's really, it's a bit of a paradigm shift in how you would do your weekly shop. Coming up next on Moolala, a budgeting app developed in Canada called Wilbur. Co-founder and CEO Mike Rodenberg is here to tell us how it's different. Hint, it pays you as you use it. Huh. And later, how well can you spot online fraud? Vivian Gauci from Home Equity Bank is here to talk about their online quiz that tests your scam sense. And stay up to date with all things Moolala by signing up for our newsletter. It comes out once a month. We only send you updates about stuff that we're doing on CBC Radio, here on Sirius XM, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, just all those sorts of things. To sign up, go to moolala.ca.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
We know how hard it can be to keep on top of your spending. It's really difficult. There's so many things coming in, going out all the time. And there has been, for a long period of time, a whole category of technology that could help you do that. Budgeting apps, like there's probably 14 million of them on the App Store and Google Play. And maybe not 14 million, maybe 13 million, but a lot. There is a new one called Wilbur. It's recently out. It's developed in Canada for Canadians, and it's got a difference. It is different in that it pays you to do stuff. So we're going to talk about that. The CEO and co-founder of Wilbur is Mike Rodenberg, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Nice to be here.
So I joke that there's 13 million apps on the App Store, maybe not 13 million, but certainly 50 for Canadians. And so I'm reticent to talk about any of them that aren't actually doing something that's new and different, because it feels like they're quite similar. The difference that caught my attention with Wilbur is that you pay people to do surveys. So let's start with the unique selling proposition of this app, and then we can talk about the other functionality that sounds similar to what other apps do. But start with the survey thing.
Yeah, so I've spent my entire career in the market research and public opinion polling business, and we actually set out trying to solve a problem with surveys, which is they're long and they're boring. And so what we decided that we could do is if we collected the purchase data from a budget app, that we could use some of that information to make the surveys shorter and more interesting and more engaging.
I see. So I downloaded the app, and I know that it wants me to connect my bank accounts and other accounts to this. And so that would then inform the types of surveys that you would send to me. And because you've already got my basic purchase data, you wouldn't have to ask me if I use, you know, or I shop at this particular store, because you'd already know.
Absolutely. And that solves a big problem in the market research field, which is most surveys, people disqualify themselves in the first few questions, and then therefore they don't get the incentive and the reward.
So am I selling you my answers to a survey, or am I selling you my purchase data?
Yeah, so you're in part selling a bit of both. You know, so the customer of ours, they'll ask for the survey data, and then they'll ask us for little pieces of your purchase history that are relevant to the survey at hand. So if it's for a fast food joint, we're going to append your fast food purchases to the survey data, and that becomes the data piece that we sell.
Interesting. And how much do I get?
So we'll compensate the respondent for anywhere between $1 and $5 per survey, depending on how long the survey is and how hard it is to qualify for.
And how many might the average user complete in a month?
You know, what we know to be true about consumer research panels is that generally people will answer about 2.5 surveys per month. So it could amount for, you know, a 20 to 30 minute time commitment per month. And for that, we might pay them somewhere between, say, $2.50 and $5 per survey if it's on the longer side. So they could earn, you know, $10. Certainly would add to their beer money, so to speak, if that's
right. It's not paying their mortgage, but they're getting a beverage.
Absolutely.
What would you say about the type of person that this is of interest for? And I ask because my 14-year-old's nuts about surveys. They're like, fill out all the surveys. Yeah. I think you'd probably have to pay me $100 to do a survey. I'm just so not interested. What is the type of person for whom this is interesting?
Yeah, so I think there's two broad cohorts of consumers that would be interested in this. One is people out looking for a budgeting app because it is a fully featured budget app that allows you to categorize your spending. You know, your purchases are automatically categorized by certain categories that, you know, help you manage your budget and live your life a more frugal manner. And there are people out there that want to use a free budgeting app. My competitors charge, say, $10 per month. We'll give that away for free. And so that's one cohort of consumers. The other cohort of consumers are people who don't mind answering surveys. And those consumers who answer the surveys will obviously be encouraged to, you know, connect their bank accounts for a better survey experience, more relevant questions, fewer disqualifications, and ultimately earn more money.
We live in a world where everybody wants our data. There are some times when we are oblivious to its collection, like how the cookies work on our browsers, and we sort of feel like we're being eavesdropped on by our, I can't say the word, but rhymes with schnoogle, because if I say the actual word, it's going to start talking to me over there. And then there are worlds in which we are more cognizant of the data that's being collected. And I think you're being pretty overt about it here.
Yes.
How do you deal with a consumer reticence to provide access to that data? Because I stopped onboarding myself to the app as soon as you asked for my account passwords or whatever. It's like, you're not having my bank accounts.
Yeah, we know there's a certain type of consumer that will be concerned about the login process, but the login process is really designed to make the app efficient and easy to use. It would be very painstaking for you to enter every individual transaction to track that budget. Much more easy just to use the system that we've built to make that all happen automatically. You know, our guarantee to the users is that we don't sell their personally identifiable information. You're not going to get marketed to. Your email's not going to end up, you know, full of spam because they're answering our surveys or using our app. We are just selling the anonymous data attached to the survey and whatever transactions that are relevant for that particular survey.
So, moving to the functionality of the app. So I got it. I get the business model. I understand the surveys and all that stuff. If we talk about the app itself, does it kind of work like Quicken or the Mint app used to work, or absolutely, you need a budget? Like, is it sort of in that realm?
Absolutely. Yeah. So many of the same features. One of the interesting features that's different in our app compared to some of the others, and it's my co-founder and I are, we're strong believers in climate change and trying to find opportunities to give consumers better information to make better purchases about their impact on the environment. And so embedded in our app is a carbon footprint estimator that allows them to know with each purchase, what is the approximate carbon footprint associated with that purchase? And hopefully, they'll, with that a little additional information, they can make better choices for the environment. So we have, you know, some of those features built in, and then obviously you can create categories and you can tag transactions. And so if you have a boat as an example, you want to be able to track the cost of your fuel and your maintenance and your mortgage. You can put all those together and track that as a separate budget item in your budget.
I have been covering these apps for a really long time. And one of my observations, and I think this is backed by the data, is from a behavioral science perspective, tracking has limited utility, especially when it's done automatically. So if you use the data, you look at it and you say, oh my God, I can't believe I'm spending that much on takeout. It really requires some sort of action to alter behavior. Otherwise, you've just got the data like they're tracking the data of the weather in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. It's like completely irrelevant to you if you don't do anything with it. So how do you make those connections such that the tracking has value?
That's a great question. You know, we give the user the information to determine whether or not they're over or under budget on each specific consumer category that they participate in. It really is up to the consumer to make the decision on whether or not they want to modify their behavior going forward if they are actually, in fact, over budget. But, you know, what we hope to be true is if we create multiple reasons to go back into the app and look at it, that they'll hopefully take some action. And so you can imagine that, you know, the compelling reason to open a budget app might be to see how you're doing on your on a specific product category. But we now have this alternative option to participate in surveys. And once they're in the app, they'll be able to check to see where they are. So the more reminder points where they are on their spending, the better the opportunity they have to change their activity.
And I can see that because it's analogous to the gamify world in which you're providing some sort of a dopamine hit to get someone even just to click on that app periodically. That makes sense to me. You said you illustrate to a user whether they are over budget or under budget. So tell me about that process by which, as a user, I set budgets for certain categories.
Yeah, so you go into the app, and then on the first screen, there's a series of line items that are automatically categorized for your spending, whether it be your entertainment budget or your living expenses. The user has the ability to set that particular budget based on their historical information. So what one of the interesting things about the app is the minute that you load your data from the bank into the app, it pulls in about, depending on the bank, anywhere from 4 months to 12 months of purchase history. And so you can very quickly see that, oh, maybe I spend $800 per month on my entertainment, and that's my historical average. And so now the user has the ability to make a decision and say, okay, every month I want to scale that back by, say, $50. And that becomes something that can become a goal. And they do that informed by their purchase history, which is really an important component of the app, because most consumers don't really have an understanding of where their money goes sometimes. And
100%.
The history is an important predictor of where they need to go in the future.
Yeah, they don't know. And even when presented with the data, they're like, that can't possibly be true. I never bought that much on DoorDash. It didn't happen.
Absolutely.
How do notifications work in your app? And I ask because I have most of them turned off on every app, but in this particular category, they can be really helpful as prompts to say you are over budget on takeout food or you're, you know, whatever. How do you employ them here?
Yeah, so we really have very few minimal prompts in the app itself. We don't, for that very reason that you say, we don't want to be bombarding the user with all sorts of notifications. But, you know, it is something that we want to add as a feature for future enhancement.
Really interesting stuff. Mike, thanks for joining us today to talk about Wilbur.
Thank you very much. It was a great time.
Mike Rodenberg is the co-founder and co-CEO of Wilbur, which is a new budgeting app that I am ambivalent about. But the interesting angle here is they will pay you to engage by doing surveys and stuff like that. How cool. Coming up later, test your scam sense with an online quiz from Home Equity Bank. But first, we'll talk to Clint Davis, CEO of the first Indigenous-owned investment dealer in Canada. It's called Cedarleaf Capital. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can head to moolala.ca. And when you're there, you can search for guest name. You can search by topic. You can listen to full episodes. You can also do the same sort of thing on any of the podcast platforms. And while you're there at Spotify or Amazon Prime or iTunes or whatever it is, download the full show and write a review, maybe even subscribe. Are you struggling with debt? Feeling like no matter what you do, you just can't get on top of it? Maybe you're nervous, but feeling like you're almost ready to take control of your financial future. Introducing Credit Canada Goal, an innovative, holistic financial coaching program designed to help you get out of debt and back into life. Credit Canada Gold takes place virtually over 6 weeks and includes live class sessions, group coaching, homework, and an accountability buddy. It's intense, but the results are amazing. And if you're accepted into the program, your tuition is covered by a scholarship, so it won't cost you a thing. Visit creditcanada.com/gold to learn more and apply for one of our upcoming programs. Take control and transform your financial future with Credit Canada Gold. Supporting Indigenous communities in finance. That is a big part of what Cedarleaf Capital is setting out to do. It is the first Indigenous-owned investment dealer in Canada. It's created between in an agreement between Scotiabank, two Indigenous-owned corporations, and a First Nation. So lots of players here to bring this to life. We're joined by Clint Davis, CEO of Cedarleaf Capital. He joins us from his vacation. We're grateful for it to talk about this news. Clint, hello.
Hi, Bruce. It's great to be here.
Now, for context, you are Inuk from the Labrador region, but I need you to pronounce more precisely where it is that you're from.
So I was born and raised in Goose Bay, Labrador. My dad is from a small Inuit community called Rigolet, which is in the Nunatsiavut region. Nunatsiavut Inuit, we were the last Inuit land claim to be settled in Canada, which was settled in 2005.
Okay. There are many different types of investment firms in this country. There's private equity, there's venture capital, there's asset management, there's all sorts of different structures. What specifically will Cedarleaf do?
So first of all, for Cedarleaf, we put an application into the regulatory agency, which is the Canadian Investment Regulatory Organization, or CIRO. So the application is in, so we haven't received approval at this point, and it's going to take a bit of time for that to actually happen. Our approach specifically in terms of capital markets is to focus in the initial stages anyway, as part of our business plan, on debt capital markets. So primarily looking at clients, which are large publicly traded corporations, as well as public governments, participating as a junior in syndicates for new bond issuances and hopefully becoming a lead of one of those syndicates sometime in the future.
And what's different here? What are you providing that wasn't, you know, once you're all set and your I's are dotted and your T's crossed, what's different now than it would have been a couple of years ago?
So a number of things which is different. So first and foremost, this is a perfect example of economic reconciliation, where you actually have Indigenous ownership and an Indigenous-led investment dealer participating in an area of finance that we have been traditionally excluded from. So in the area of capital markets, there's very little representation of Indigenous people in this space here in Canada. So this is the first ever to happen, and it demonstrates that Indigenous ownership. The other piece is, as a result, I think, of the changing business world that we see with a greater focus on Indigenous economic development, more and more opportunities are starting to come forward where there is an Indigenous component to it. Some of the major renewable energy projects that we see across Canada, all of which would have an Indigenous piece to it. And so some of that requires significant capital, and we believe that Cedarleaf Capital will be that strong competitor and bring that differentiated advantage.
As is the case in every part of this country, there is tremendous diversity when it comes to Indigenous communities for lots and lots of different reasons. And unfortunately, in the headlines, we hear a lot about poverty and boil water advisories, but there are also many communities who have significant financial resources. Tell us about that, the nations that have, you know, mineral rights and just this incredible entrepreneurial spirit and resources.
It's a brilliant question. In fact, we're really lucky to have three of those leading business-oriented communities, those that have a strong track record, strong leadership, and projects that demonstrate their commitment to responsible and prudent economic development. Nichkai is Squamish out of British Columbia. They're embarking upon a significant $1.3 billion residential mixed, you know, residential plus commercial property in North Van. Des Nede, which is owned by English River, they had a longstanding relationship with Cameco and have extended that into real estate development in Saskatoon. And then Rama First Nation, which is an economic powerhouse in terms of its investments in gaming, but they have gone beyond that and are looking at other opportunities as well. So there have been a number of different pressures that have come forward, I think, that really have resulted in some wonderful growth that's happened with communities. Some is the resolution of land claims, for which there is a financial injection as a result of that. And with that financial component, many communities have looked at investment in business as a way to sustain that financial source. And then others who are have asserted Indigenous rights, and that requirement for duty to consult, accommodate, and even looking towards consent have translated into business opportunities for resource development that happened across the country. All of this, though, Bruce, does require strong leadership and some community, strong leadership, strong governance, and a separation of business and politics for these communities.
The answer to this question is nuanced and long, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And that is, what would you say about the cultural context in which Indigenous businesses operate? To say that there are different ways of thinking, there's different ways of acting, there's a different belief structure, there's the medicine wheel, there's like so many other things that inform how Indigenous communities think about business, some cultural, some based on history, which has been sometimes horrendous. How do you bring that in to the work of Cedarleaf?
So it's a brilliant question. And in fact, you know, it's interesting because I was the chair of my community's development corporation over a decade. And we didn't have any political leaders on our board. But one of the things, there were two things which were absolutely critical for us. Obviously, you want to make sure that any of the businesses that you're operating in are sustainable, generating enough revenue, generating enough return in order to ensure that you're generating that value and creating that value for your shareholder. But honestly, we would always talk about impact of any of our businesses or partnerships on the land, because many of our citizens still use the land for cultural and traditional purposes. And we'd focus on ensuring that we'd have some development and training of our own people to work in the businesses that we were actually hiring. So it's kind of interesting where over the last 5 years to 10 years, you've seen this really big push around, you know, ESG and, you know, companies that need to really look at social considerations for investment and impact on the environment. It's interesting because we've always thought that, and it just became sort of ingrained. So I love the question around different ways of thinking, different sort of cultural contexts. These three shareholders, you rightly stated, are from three different regions. They have not done business together before. But they all have had a relationship with Scotiabank. And that's how, when we pitched this idea to them, that's how they came on board. They all have their own way of doing business. And I think what we're going to do as a differentiator for Cedarleaf is to be able to bring some of that thinking, some of that vision, and I believe some of those new types of investors as well to capital markets.
Tell us about the name. What is the significance of Cedarleaf as a name?
Cedarleaf is a very powerful plant. That's the cedar, the tree itself. It's a very powerful image for many, predominantly First Nation communities across Canada. It's a medicine. It's a tree that exists in all three regions where our shareholders are actually from. It's something which, it demonstrates strength, it demonstrates continuity, it demonstrates the leaves itself have medicinal purposes. And so with that, the discussion was around ensuring that when we created this investment dealer, that we were looking many generations ahead. And so it had that longevity and strong roots to the country. Mm.
You've got a pretty impressive track record. I looked at your LinkedIn profile, law degree, master's in public administration from Harvard, and you spent 20 years working in Indigenous banking with, you know, some big firms. As you reflect on that time, what would you say has changed and what hasn't changed when it comes to including Indigenous communities in the sort of financial ecosystem?
So, great question. I think what's changed is this natural progression towards, particularly, I mean, we're a natural resource-based country, right? So that natural progression towards engaging, involving, including Indigenous communities that could be perceived as being impacted on whatever development that would be. The fascinating thing about this, Bruce, is that you know, we've seen this happen with renewable energy. We've seen it happen in the mining sector. And now it's expanding to include almost all facets or many facets of infrastructure across Canada. So that has been absolutely exciting. The challenge now is getting that access to equity so that communities actually have a source of capital to participate as equity owners into those projects where it actually makes sense. What hasn't changed? So there's a couple of areas. We're starting to see some change around Indigenous leadership at large corporations, public traded corporations. We're seeing some Indigenous leadership on boards. There should be more. The representation we have as Indigenous people, there has to be greater diversity on corporate boards anyway across Canada. It's something where I think the country is lagging. And you're seeing some strong leadership happening across the board with some companies, but I think we need to do more. The other area is in the area of investment management and finance, where some communities, or collectively communities, have probably in excess of about $15 billion. Wow. And these are, they're managed by, as you can imagine, investment managers. And there is just a handful of individuals who are Indigenous who are out there managing all this capital. And as you can imagine, and I've heard it sort of anecdotally, where at times the investment policy, the investment manager, they're going down the road of investing in certain securities, which may not necessarily be aligned with the values of the community. And so I think there needs to be that push of greater inclusion of Indigenous people in that space as well.
Really interesting stuff. Well, best of luck as you move to the next chapter with Cedarleaf, and thanks for joining us today.
Nakumik, Bruce, always great to see you.
Clint Davis, CEO of Cedarleaf Capital, the first Indigenous-owned investment dealer in Canada. Coming up, staying safe online. Fraudsters are at the ready. How can you defend yourself? Vivian Gauchis, Home Equity Bank's SVP, is going to be here to talk about an online quiz that tests your scam sense. I'm also the money columnist for CityLine, which is a daily lifestyle show on the air. It's been on the air for decades and decades. And I've got lots of opinions and tips and ideas about how to get a better handle on your money. You can go to cityline.tv and search for me. And you'll find some of the stuff that we've done over the last couple months, I guess, and years. I just celebrated 10 years as the money columnist on CityLine. It's crazy. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Fraudsters are becoming more and more sophisticated. And we often think seniors are more likely to fall victim to these scams. But data from Ipsos and Home Equity Bank has found boomers are no more likely to be victimized than any other generation. To bring more awareness to Canadians on how to stay safe online, Home Equity Bank has developed this online quiz to help people test their scam sense. To talk about the quiz and the latest in fraud, I'm joined by Vivian Gauchis, Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer at Home Equity Bank. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
I did the quiz. I was happy with how I did on the quiz, actually, but I have to take so many of these training courses at work, so I better have done okay. Tell us more about some of the things that you're testing in this quiz.
Well, I'm glad to hear you did well, Bruce, and that's what we're seeing, is that people are doing well, but sometimes they're surprised. And so what we were trying to do with our scam sense test was trying to help educate people on what some of the common themes and topics and some of the signs that they should be looking out for when faced with a potential fraud situation. So we know that knowledge is power. educating yourself is the number one thing you can do to protect yourself from potential frauds and scams. And we thought, why don't we create this quiz to make it a bit more fun for people to test their own knowledge and learn while they're at it.
So I said I did well on that, but you track results across demographics. What have you learned in terms of looking at those results? Or how are people doing on the quiz?
Well, it's pretty incredible, Bruce. We did this survey where we looked at Canadians and we tested to see what people thought would be the outcome in terms of people who are most likely to be scammed. And what wasn't surprising is that 2 out of every 3 people believe that older Canadians are the most likely scam victims. And our past research has shown us that they indeed tend to be very highly targeted. But what we found, the surprising finding, was that the reality is that it's the youngest Canadians who tend to engage in some of the riskiest behaviors online that puts them at risk. So they might be connecting to public Wi-Fi without watching out for, you know, any potential hazards. They'll be using things like autofill for credit card information, passwords, or using the same password for multiple accounts. So while it is true that older generations tend to be very highly targeted, and while everybody believes that they're the most likely to be scammed, what we found was it was actually older generations who are least likely to engage in some of this risky behavior.
Very interesting.
And they're always constantly on guard and worried about their safety while they're online.
Very interesting. One of the questions on the test that this one I got correct, but I totally guessed. It was AI generated photos. Why was this something that we should be learning more about?
Well, it's incredible to see what is happening right now in the world of AI. And rightfully so, most Canadians are saying in this survey, they're saying that they are worried about AI technologies. So 4 out of every 5 Canadians did say they are worried about AI technologies, the emergence of AI technologies, because it is so difficult to identify what's real and what isn't given an AI image. So it's one of those things that we have to watch out for that is emerging as one of the tools that fraudsters are using. They're using AI to imitate voices. They're using AI to imitate images. And so it is one of those emerging types of fraud that we all have to be mindful of.
Where does this go, the AI evolution or revolution in terms of scams? Like I am continually surprised. As you look at the where AI plays here, are there futurists who are predicting calamity ahead?
Well, I like to think of the glass as half full, Bruce. So I like to think that AI technology will help improve our overall situation. And there's a lot of good that can be had from AI technologies. But the reality is that people who are likely to, you know, try and defraud others will also use these AI tools, and they'll use them for not so great reasons. So I do think that we as a population need to become better educated and more aware of the potential of these tools to be able to defraud and to scam others. We're seeing instances now, for example, where video is starting to be created, and you know, you can upload 30 seconds of you speaking into a camera, and then all of a sudden an AI technology is able to create a whole video of you based on a script that you produce, and all of a sudden here you are on camera saying things that you haven't actually said,
right?
But it actually looks like you.
Oh,
so the technology is advancing at quite a clip, and so it's important for all of us to stay aware and to stay in touch with how this technology is evolving so that we can be prepared just in case things seem to not quite line up or be off.
This quiz and your survey are kind of the latest in your focus on fraud. You've got lots of material on your website. You've got a four-part series to catch the scam, the CRA scam, the lottery scam, the romance scam, the grandparent scam. Really helpful for people to educate themselves on those basics. The one that people probably, that I certainly have talked less about though, is home improvement scams. You did a whole webinar on this. What are some things that you would want people to be aware of when it comes to home improvement?
Again, education is key here, Bruce. So if somebody's coming to your door and trying to sell you something that you don't think you necessarily need, just be mindful. Don't be afraid to comparison shop. So something that looks like a piece of technology that's going to help improve your overall, for example, heating efficiency or your water usage efficiency. This is all great. Obviously, this is something that all of us should aspire to do from a environmentally consciousness perspective. But it's important for us to not rush to sign anything and not rush to commit to anything. There's nothing wrong with you taking a pause and saying, okay, wonderful, thank you very much. I will get back to you, right? And then this is where you can do your homework. You can ask around, does this price seem right for what this person is selling me? Does it make sense for me to be installing this right now? Do I really need this? So when it comes to home improvement scams, your best friends are usually time and knowledge, educating yourself and making sure that you can actually go and do your own homework as to what it is that people are proposing to you. There's nothing wrong with you taking a pause and telling somebody that you'll have to get back to them.
I was the victim of identity theft about 18 months ago. And there were two things that really surprised me. And it was horrible and took forever to figure out. But the first thing that surprised me was how it was almost entirely my responsibility to lead the resolution. Like there was websites out there and the institutions were okay, but I was captain on getting this thing resolved for myself. The second thing was the weaknesses that we have in this country in terms of reporting and prosecuting the fraudsters themselves. So we do have the Anti-Fraud Center, but what's your best advice to people who have been victims? What can they do about it?
Well, this is one of those areas where it is difficult, Bruce. I completely agree with you. There's, you are a little bit on your own and you have to advocate for yourself if you have been a victim of identity theft. But I would recommend a few things. First, obviously do report it to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. They keep an eye on trends. They do overall reporting on what it is that is happening. And they help educate Canadians on what they should be looking out for. Report it to the police and to your financial institutions as well, because they can give you the resources and the guidance that you need in order to help remedy. And of course, in the case of identity theft specifically, going to the credit bureaus, because of course, what you want to make sure is that you're not further victimized. Yeah. So you want to make sure that they're putting alerts on their accounts so that people can't access more credit in your name, for example.
Yeah. And take some patience pills because it's going to take some time to resolve.
Lots of time, yes.
Vivian, thanks for your insight today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. And if anybody else wants to test their scam sense and find out how unscammable they might be, I encourage them all to visit chip.ca/fraud to see how unscammable you are.
That's great. Vivian Gauci, Senior Vice President, Chief Marketing Officer at Home Equity Bank, joined us to talk about both the resources that they have on fraud and also a quick, simple, what's not that simple? I'll say simple. Simple to use test, maybe not simple to excel at. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you would like to get in touch with us for any reason, comments, questions, feedback, whatever, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast on any of the podcast platforms. And on social media, I'm Bruce Celery on X, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening today. Have a great day.